All right, so the principle is this, that the death and resurrection of Jesus is the unifying interpretive center of the scriptures according to the scriptures. Let me say that again. You might want to write it down. The death and resurrection of Jesus is the unifying interpretive center of the scriptures according to the scriptures. So if we're to teach the Bible as Christians, then we must show a legitimate connection from any one Old Testament text to the gospel of Christ in the New Testament. Kind of looks like this. If the Old Testament was all heading towards Jesus and the gospel, then the New Testament is looking back, explaining it. Okay? Christ is the interpretive center. He's not just the most important part of our Bibles. He's not just the centerpiece or focal point of our Bibles, though that's kind of true. He's the interpretive center. He's the interpretive key. And so the Old Testament was anticipating his arrival. The Gospels announce his arrival. And then the rest of the New Testament explains and applies his coming and his second coming. Okay? Now, I said the death and resurrection of Jesus is the unifying interpretive center of the scriptures according to the scriptures. Where? Well, how about Luke 24? Let's turn there. Luke 24. We'll see Jesus help us out with this. Jesus thinks that he is the unifying interpretive center of the scriptures according to the scriptures. Someone read for us Luke 24, 17 to 23.
And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things have happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it, just as the women had said, but him they did not see."
That's good. We'll stop there. So these guys know about Jesus. These guys are Bible guys. These guys are known to be disciples of Jesus. They have no doubt heard Jesus teach and preach. They considered him a mighty prophet. They hoped he would be the one to redeem Israel. In other words, they thought that he was the Messiah. They also know about his crucifixion. And they've also heard a rumor about his resurrection. And yet, they stood still looking sad. They've got so much data about Jesus, and yet they're missing the interpretive key that makes sense of all the data. So now, someone read, verse 25 to 27.
"And he said to them, O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself."
The Christ should suffer and enter into glory. So apparently the Old Testament didn't just sort of vaguely point ahead to Messiah, but a suffering, glorified Messiah. Now let's have someone just read a few more verses and we'll be done with Luke 24. 44 to 47.
He said to them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, "Thus it is written, that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance for the forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem."
Yeah, so now we have the purpose of the suffering and resurrection, right? For the forgiveness of sins. This is the interpretive center, the interpretive key to the whole Bible. Jesus said the law and the prophets were pointing ahead to this moment, to this thing. Now, when we come to that word gospel, some of us want to debate what is the gospel. Some of us like big gospel, some of us like narrow gospel. At least in 1 Corinthians 15, it is Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection for the forgiveness of sins. We might want to say that that is the anchor for the gospel. It holds weight in a way that no other part of a broader gospel ever could. In other words, if you say, "I think the gospel is Messiah's arrival and his kingship and something like that," no one gets saved because of that. So there has to be something here in that, what I would call the gospel weekend of Friday, the cross, and Sunday, the resurrection. Without that, there is no forgiveness of sins. So there's a certain weight to the gospel on that gospel weekend. And yet we do want to admit the gospel, that word gospel, has implications and significance far beyond the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Do we agree with that? Is that fair enough? We covered enough of the bases between big G gospel and small G gospel, or gospel weekend and gospel implications. Now here's something that might help us. I call this the Bullmore chart, Mike Bullmore. You do your own diagram and it's really good, and you just get, it's called your name, right? So this is the Bullmore chart. Here we have the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Let's kind of build out from there. Okay, this was his life and ministry. Okay, now let's remember there was an incarnation, right? And this second person of the Trinity, before he was born in Bethlehem, he was God. He is eternal. There is an eternal past. And then the Old Testament is somewhere along these lines, right? Somewhere between eternity past and his incarnation. So we're already seeing that the life and ministry, the anticipation of Jesus and the fulfillment of Jesus is a little more complex or built out than just this gospel weekend of the cross and resurrection. In fact, it goes from there. You got the resurrection. He's on the earth for a few days, few weeks, months. And then we have the what? Ascension. And then where is he now? Right hand of the Father, right? So we can call this his present reign. We call it a lot of things, but that'll work. He's coming again, right? So, that's his return, second coming. Now, some of you think that there's a rapture that happens somewhere around before or after that. Some of us will wonder if there's a millennium here. Let's just, whatever you think of that, it's either here or here. But he'll bring us to himself, right? So this is the resurrection, the final resurrection. And then, and this is also what we could call the consummation. Again, whatever your eschatology is, you might have more space in there than I would, for instance. And what's there going to be? A new heaven and a new earth for eternity future. This is the ministry of Christ. This is the big picture of the gospel. Now, this has saving weight to it. It's absolutely necessary. I personally, just this is not every Simeon instructor will say this, I personally have a conviction that in every sermon I preach at our church, because there are enough visitors, enough non-Christians with us, I'm going to get to this at some point. I have the conviction to not miss the opportunity to give enough information about the gospel so that someone unsaved could get saved this coming Sunday. That's just my personal conviction. Other guys would say, hey, not every passage takes you right there. I agree with that. Not every passage takes you right there. In fact, we've got to be thinking, where does my Old Testament passage land best with the various aspects of the life and ministry and coming and return of Jesus? And it might be here. It might be there. It might be his birth. It might be right there. It might be there. It might be here. It often is right there. So this makes biblical theology or preaching Christ or finding Christ now way more difficult and way more interesting. This means that my sermons can't just vaguely say at the end, and my people know this is coming, right? And that reminds us of Jesus, doesn't it? Have you ever done that? Right? Or, you know, it's an Old Testament passage on sin, and then you just sort of say, and this is why we need Jesus, right? Well, it is true, but we probably can get more nuanced than that, okay? Let me put it like this. There are multiple ways that my text might get to the gospel, and we're looking for the best one. We're looking for the most natural, organic, and strong connection between my Old Testament text and what the New Testament says. Now help me out. Let's brainstorm together. What are some strategies we might use to ascertain connections between Old Testament and New? What kind of strategies?
Common themes.
Common themes, okay. Put that down, and we'll build on that in just a bit.
It's quoted directly in the New Testament.
Yeah, those are the easy ones, right? How about, let's just add this, allusions, right? Sometimes it's not a direct quote, but it's close enough. It's paraphrased, and you go, oh, okay. Now, let me just pause here on this one. You guys should all know that there are helps available to you that you can use, and they're not cheating. So the Bibles that we have been given graciously this week don't have this, but most Bibles, in my Bible, it's a center column. You see that? You might have it at the bottom of the page. This center column, these are called cross-references. Now, they're not inspired, but guys a whole lot, and women, a whole lot smarter than you, that know the Bible better than you and me, put these in here, and these are not just this reminds me of that passage kind of references. Or if you really want to dig deep in this theme, you should look at these verses. These are citations or allusions. So when you're in an Old Testament text, these things in the center column, these references, are here for you. Let me be blunt. Your worksheet should not overlook these. This is right here. This is easy stuff. You say, well, I didn't know it was quoted in Acts 7. It was probably in the margin of a either. I'm preaching Numbers, Exodus 24 later today. There are all kinds of connections to the New Testament in a passage like that. So take advantage of that. Use the column in your ESV or whatever. If you really want to be thorough with that, you get a Nestle-Aland 28th edition Greek New Testament, and you say, I don't know Greek. It doesn't matter. It's worth the price of the book for what's called the apparatus at the back. The apparatus is like this stuff in the center column on steroids. It's legit.
Do you see what that is again?
The Nestle, N-E-S-T-L-E, dash Aland with a D at the end, Greek New Testament. I think whatever the newest edition is, I think it's 28th. All right. Hobby horse, off the soapbox. Quotations, allusions, themes. What else? How about typology? Let me give you a definition of typology, because not all of us have that under our belt very well. My definition, just wrote it down this morning, a person, place, or object in the Old Testament that sets a pattern for fuller realization in the New. Okay? A person, place, or object in the Old Testament that sets a pattern for fuller realization in the New Testament. That's what I mean by typology. Related to that would be analogy. Dave Helms' little book on expositional preaching is probably the best inroad, the best introduction to these kinds of things. There's a whole chapter on theological reflection, goes through things like typology, analogy. What else would be covered in that chapter? How about, I mean, it's kind of related to typology, but biblical theological themes? What are some big ones in the Old Testament that we should be watching for?
Sacrifice.
Temple. See how these are also, in some ways, typology. Priesthood.
Exile.
Kingship. Big one. Big one if you're in for Samuel. 2 Samuel. All right. So that's probably enough. Let's now, with these strategies in mind, let's also do this. Let's talk about benefits, and then we'll get into some texts. Now, what are some benefits? I don't even like the word benefits because it sounds like it's a plus, like it's an advantage. It's a necessity, right? But with this necessity in mind of getting to Jesus in the most natural, organic, helpful way possible, there are benefits. What are they? What does this kind of preaching do for a church, for a preacher?
Unifies the Bible.
Yeah, it's one, it makes sense of the story. We have lots of stories put together. It is making up one grand narrative of the plan of God. One eternal plan of salvation makes much of Jesus, right? That's what you said, Aaron. Yeah. In that regard, since Jesus is the unifying interpretive center of the whole Bible according to the Bible, it just makes sense of the Bible, right? I mean, there's no Bible without doing this. We lose the Bible. We're not staying on the line. We're below the line. I mean, one of the dangers of not doing this is we're just moralizing. Old Testament stories are just moralized. And so another benefit is we actually get the gospel out. I mean, there's an apologetic value to this stuff, right? People can get saved next Sunday as you show the necessity and the anticipation and then the fulfillment of Christ's coming as the answer for this world. So there are all kinds of benefits. You just think of the beautiful heartburn that those two men in the road to Emmaus had, right? Jesus unfolded the scriptures, showing himself as the focal point of it all. And they said, did our hearts not burn within us? There are many benefits. We could go on with that. Let's instead do some examples, some exercises. I'm going to have you partner up, and you're going to get 5 whole minutes, I think. Turn to Exodus 16. Exodus 16. It's the story of the manna. It's a bit of a long chapter, but take advantage of what you know of Exodus 16. And here's what you're going to do. You're going to look for, you're going to think of best ways to get to the New Testament from Exodus 16. Okay? And then we'll pull our ideas together after about 5 minutes. Go for it. All right, guys. Let's gather up. Let's start with this. Let's start with bad ways to apply Exodus 16. And I'll go with the first one. God will always provide for you. That's true, but we don't get that from Exodus 16. We're not them. We're not in the wilderness. We're not the children of Israel in those days. So bad application, right? What keeps me from going there? Ah, what the New Testament does with Exodus 16 should keep me from going there, right? In addition to just reading Exodus 16 in its historical context and realizing that God doesn't promise to provide for us in exactly the same way. All right, so then the New Testament, how do we get to the New Testament from Exodus 16? What'd you find? John 6, just 32? 32 and following, right? I mean, this is a whole story built upon the manna. Everyone know that? Everyone, did you just know that?
Yeah, when I remember Jesus saying, I'm the bread of life, and that's what I was John 6.
Okay. Yeah, good. Yeah, some passages you'll know, wait a minute, manna's dealt with someplace else, isn't it? Was it John 6 or John 7? I don't remember. Which one's the water? Which one's the bread? Yeah, okay, yeah, John 6. And then other times, you'll be using that center row of your Bible and looking, oh, okay, this passage actually gets quoted in John 6. We need to go there? We need to look at John 6? Or did everyone already do that? Yeah, I mean, it's John 6, 32 to, I think it's 31, where the people say, well, God gave us manna. Our fathers ate manna in the wilderness. What are you going to do? And all the way to 51, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. It's probably not any coincidence that Exodus 17 is water from the rock. In John 7 is Jesus talking about how he's living water. Right? All right. What else? Is John 6 the only place the New Testament picks up Exodus 16?
No, it's in 2 Corinthians 8.
We will talk about the ultimate rest. So the pattern of work and rest, 6 days work, 7 days rest, rest.
Okay, yeah. So the whole Sabbath thing. Yeah, there are several passages like Hebrews 4 that unpack the typological significance of the Sabbath. Aaron, you said 2 Corinthians 8?
Yeah, it's a bad one. It's about giving.
Let's bring us. Let's explore this. 2 Corinthians 8.
Verse
Read it for us.
It's the whoever has, you know, much with not having lack.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. 2 Corinthians 8. Can someone...
15. As it is written, whoever gathered much had nothing left over. Whoever gathered little had no lack.
Yeah. All right. So Paul uses Exodus 16 in an analogical way to show God's provision, right? He actually gets to God's provision, but he gets to God's provision by way of analogy, not just direct moralizing from Exodus 16. Where else? There's one more at least. Grumbling. 1 Corinthians 10. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul is giving a list of Israelite failures and divine punishments for those failures. One of them is the golden calf. That's one of the things he's listing in 1 Corinthians 10. Another one was the rock with water. That's Exodus 17. But one of them is the grumbling. So 1 Corinthians 10, verse 10. Someone read that for us.
Nor should we complain if some of them did and were killed by the destroyer.
Yeah, would you read on so we get the point Paul's making here?
Now these things happened to them as examples, and they were written as a warning to us, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Whoever thinks he stands must be careful not to fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to humanity. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted now, but you are able. With the temptation, he will also provide a way of escape.
Great.
You are able to bear it.
Yep. Thank you. So Paul here is using Exodus 16 by way of warning to Christians. So what do I do? What's my sermon going to do? Not everyone would agree with this, I suppose. Maybe some guys would say, you should have one New Testament connection, that's it. And if so, then this is probably the most important one, because it's the longest one. It's the one that defines Jesus. You got to get Jesus right. That's a big deal. But if you're okay with having two, I'm a kind of guy that would be okay with that myself. Then, okay, then maybe 1 Corinthians 10:10 is on the other side of John 6, and we're talking about how the story of Exodus 16 still speaks today by way of warning, not always just by way of comfort in full bellies or satisfied in salvation or something like that. All right, let's do another one. We've got a few minutes more before we'll stop for some questions. Exodus 26. Turn there. And we're not going to look at the particulars of the verses. I'll just tell you, this is the chapter giving instructions about the tabernacle. So if you want to turn there to jog your memory, do it. If you want to turn there to look at the cross references in your Bible, feel free to do that. But now knowing Exodus 26 is instruction for the building of the tabernacle, I'm preaching Exodus 26. Where am I thinking I might also be going in the Bible, in the New Testament?
Revelation 21.
Yeah. The dwelling place of God is with man. Right, tabernacle language and temple language gets picked up in Revelation 21 and 22. Good. John 1, one verse specifically. What's the best one? 14. Yeah, he dwelt among us. He literally, it's the Greek word for he tabernacled. He tabernacled among us. So, I mean, Jesus is the literal embodiment of the tabernacle. He is God's presence. He said of his body, you know, it's you tear down this temple and in 3 days I'll rebuild it.
It talks about the veil. So you can go to 2 Corinthians chapter 3.
Okay, yeah, 2 Corinthians 3, the veil.
Matthew 27:51.
Okay, Matthew 27:51. Now keep in mind, this is Tuesday sermon prep. Exodus 26 is coming on Sunday. At this point, I'm just, excuse the expression, I'm just throwing up on the page. I'm just putting Bible verses down. I don't need to decide yet which one's the best one. So I want to be as exhaustive as possible with possible connections, because one might surprise me. And then I might, after a while of throwing up on the page, I might remember, wait a minute, there's a really big one. I forgot about that one. Hebrews 9 deals with it and goes through the details of the parts of the tabernacle, just like my passage in Exodus does. For 12 verses, Hebrews unpacks the significance of the tabernacle and how that was, it had glory, but now we have something better in the ministry of Christ. Right? All right, let me stop there. If you have questions, I'll try to answer them.